Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Perhaps people who need to be reminded about ethics end up like this.
Now they're saying I groped a male staffer. Yeah, I did.
I committed no wrongdoing whatsoever.
And I'm a high-profile person.
You don't want to give up the perks of power, the chairmanships.
Hello, Roland. This is Rob Blagojevich again. How are you?
I know you're calling telling me that you're going to make me king of the world.
Maybe we all need reminders about ethics, but people in government? Being in public, paid with tax dollars like that, knowing their every move is watched, you'd think, well, maybe not.
Not only did I grope him, I tickled him until he couldn't breathe.
Ethics by committee in Congress. Is anybody paying attention? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, March 12th, back in New York from Miami. And the question really is this morning, do you think about ethics when you're being tickled by a congressman from Western New York?
Please save me from ever being tickled or groped by any congressman.
Serious story, though, crossing anywhere. Right now on the wires. They got more to worry about than ethics down in Washington. Obama is delaying his Asia trip from March 18th to March 21st.
Until the 21st to work on health care. He's demanded it be on his desk next week, and it may not happen. On other news, a judge is going to decide today if a settlement that could pay more than $600 million to rescue and recovery workers who became ill after the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York. It covers more than 10,000 cops, firefighters, and construction workers, many of whom claim they suffer from respiratory illnesses and blood cancer. This first responder tells CNN this morning.
I'm 52 years old, and they told me I got lungs of a 90-year-old man.
Earlier, we spoke to Fred Mogul, a reporter with our partner WNYC here in New York. He says there's a large scale of illnesses. Some on the lower end with mild symptoms would expect to get a few thousand dollars out of the settlement. On the top end, some people can expect payouts in the millions.
People worked in a lot of different capacities over a lot of different durations there, and they were exposed to a lot of different things, and they have a lot of different illnesses.
The judge and the plaintiff still have to agree on the settlement, though.
A tough milestone in Haiti. 2 months ago today, that earthquake hit the nation, leaving over 200,000 dead and millions homeless. We're going to talk about what's going on the ground and how the economy is recovering in Haiti, if it even can. We're joined by Melody Munns, who's an environmental health coordinator for the International Rescue Committee in Haiti. Melody, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Melody, in some sense, the international aid effort is the economy of Haiti right now. Is it able to benefit Haitians on a permanent basis, or will the economy leave when the aid effort leaves?
I think that the aid community is engaging. We are all engaging as many Haitians as we possibly can and in roles that are as close to their previous professional roles. That take advantage of the training they already have and build on that. So, yes, I think that we will actually have something to contribute to the future of Haiti.
Well, stay with us, Melody Munns. So coming up, the challenges of hiring Haitian in the earthquake-devastated zone.
House Democrats will meet again this morning to try and iron out more of the wrinkles in the health care bill. President Obama wants to have the completed bill on his desk by next week, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that's unlikely. New economic numbers out last hour show a surprising increase in retail sales last month. Sales were up 0.3%. That's actually the biggest gain since November. And remember, just a reminder, unless you live in Arizona or Hawaii, you are going to lose an hour this weekend because of daylight saving time. The clocks spring forward Saturday night. And we've been thinking about time this morning. Do you have enough of it? And what would you do with an extra hour every day?
Time in a bottle.
I would listen to John sing,
no, you
maybe.
Wouldn't. That would be a wasted hour.
What would you do with more time?
This is David from Worcester, Mass. Since this is a fantasy question, I'm going to give you a fantasy answer. If I had an extra hour every day, I would give it away to a terminally ill person because that's probably wasted anyway.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org.
Positive retail news moving the markets. Futures are way up. The Dow gets underway in a half hour at 10,611. The S&P opens at 1,150 and the NASDAQ at 2,368. We conclude our Genius series this hour. We've been doing it all week. And in just a few minutes, a conversation based on what Haiti needs. Your voice has motivated it in just a moment.
What Haiti needs right now is jobs.
Harry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Well, one of the reasons I went down to South Florida this week was to really engage the South Florida community. And, of course, they listened to The Takeaway on WLRN, which is where we were broadcasting from. And it was amazing just how connected South Florida is to Haiti compared with the rest of the United States, although the rest of the United States isn't unconnected, that's for sure. It's definitely been a part of the
aid. Yeah, but there's definitely a very real bond between, immediate bond.
Well, there's signs all over Miami, you know, indicating Haitian sort of contribution zones. If you go to the airport, there are special signs for Haitian charter flights, which have been added since the earthquake. It is 2 months ago today since the earthquake struck Haiti, a nation that we have described multiple times on this program as the poorest, one of the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. It's fair to say that 2 months after the earthquake, the extraordinary aid effort that's gone into Haiti constitutes much of the economy there right now. And the question for our listeners in South Florida, and really for all of you this week, has been, what does Haiti need right now? And a couple of listeners really had this notion that Haiti is a poor country, and the question is all about sustainability in Haiti. They had this very much in mind. Listen.
My name is Paula Santaloy. I think what Haiti needs right now is jobs, and the best way to do it, we need to go back to our roots, which is agricultural, which we can feed our own people. Until we start feeding our own people, we're still going to have a lot of problems.
Agricultural jobs, that's one challenge. But here, this listener said, there's another source of jobs.
I think Haiti can really benefit from the organizations going to Haiti to bring help, UNICEF, Red Cross, you name it. But I hope that they will also hire people in Haiti, Haitians who are qualified, who know the culture, they know the country, give them the opportunity to have a job.
Two listeners who reached us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So joining us this morning is Franoshka Telemark. She's a Haitian citizen. Good morning, Franoshka.
Good morning.
And you have a brand new job at Oxfam, one of the aid organizations in Haiti, right?
Yes, it's true.
And what department are you working in?
Administration.
You're in administration. And if you look around, are you in the office now?
Well, actually, yes, I'm in the office now.
All right. If you look around, are there a lot of Haitians working with you?
Yes, they are. And everybody's actually booking to their jobs and their work and everything.
And is there a perception among Haitians that the aid organizations need to hire more locally?
I'm not aware of that info because I haven't looked for myself, but I know that everybody who wants to apply for a job in NGO or so, they can do that, and it's open.
Melody Muntz, how long can someone like Franoshka expect to have a job, do you think?
Well, for qualified people and people who show progress and basically people who are committed to the project, they will stay with us as long as we are here, which that is also, that's donor-dependent and project-dependent, so we could be here anywhere from a year to three, even longer years.
And typically, do aid agency jobs, NGO jobs, translate into the broader economy in Haiti, or would it be better to invest in agricultural work and agricultural workers, as one of our listeners suggested?
Well, not to diminish the need for agricultural impact or input, but I think that the NGOs working here, we actually draw from already technically trained people, people with university degrees in sociology, engineering, nurses, medicine, lawyers, people with trades, and we build on those skills. Our teams are comprised entirely of Haitian nationals, and so we identify needs and projects. We work with the team to identify how we're going to solve them, and then they go and implement the program. So I think that they're learning some basic project management. They're getting some confidence in actually making things happen. So I believe that all of the aid agencies and international rescue community in particular, we are working really hard to build the capacity of the national staff.
It makes
our programs more effective, and it also leaves something behind.
And certainly, I don't mean to sound critical, but I think Melody Muntz, who's with the International Rescue Committee in Haiti, who claims that virtually all of her staff is Haitian nationals, you know, the issue is really troublesome for Haiti, which depends so much on international aid. Franoshka Telemark, down there at Oxfam, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. Do Haitians worry that when the aid effort is finished, that the jobs are going to go away as well? So where do the jobs go? Where can you work if Oxfam decides that things are going pretty well in Haiti right now?
Actually, I have one of my colleagues from administration, and she has more info about that.
Oh, can I talk to her?
Yes, of course.
All right.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your name, ma'am?
My name is Sonia Gelye. I'm the HR manager for the National for Haiti.
All right. And my question to you is, are Haitians worried that when the aid effort stops in Haiti, that the jobs will go away? Where will the jobs come from when the aid effort is over?
What we are thinking about now is hiring people for at least for 2 years, because the response is going to be at least for more than 1 year. Let's say for finance, we have hired people for with open-ended contracts. Where we are working in emergency, like on the field with shelter and everything, we are hiring people for 6 months with possibility of extension.
So thanks so much there to Maria Gelly and Franoshka Telemark. You get the voices right there from Haiti. Those are two workers at Oxfam talking about hiring for aid and development positions in Haiti. Melody Munns also joined us. She is the environmental health coordinator for the International Rescue Committee. Good news that the jobs are long, but it just underscores the severity of the situation. Coming up, we're going to take a listen to what else people have been saying. You've been asking all week, what does Haiti need from the world right now? And you've been telling us detailed descriptions of what you think Haiti needs. Here's another set of voices.
This is Larry Sherman. The sad truth about Haiti is that these tents that people are now living in are more structurally sound and better able to withstand earthquakes than the buildings that they had previously been living in. So before new ground is broken, they need to develop strict building codes.
I think with all the overage of shipping containers in the States, that would be an excellent answer to temporary shelter for Haitians and afterwards recycling for needed metals.
All kinds of great ideas on shelter, how to boost the economy. We'll hear more of what you said in about 10 minutes. Tell us what you think on any subject on the program, of course, at 877-8MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following.
In the past few minutes, we've learned President Obama will delay his upcoming trip to Asia to keep working on his healthcare overhaul plan. The trip was scheduled for March 18th to the 21st. This hour, House Democrats are meeting again to talk about those healthcare proposals. Among the issues still to be resolved, a decision on federal subsidies for low and middle income earners. Today, a judge in New York will consider a settlement involving thousands of rescue and recovery workers who were sickened by dust from the destroyed World Trade Center on 9/11. The deal's up to $657 million. Earlier, we spoke to one of the plaintiffs, Glenn Klein, a retired NYPD officer who was at the World Trade Center on 9/11 and in the weeks after. He said he and his colleagues were intent on rescuing innocent people, not worrying about what the long-term effects on their health would be.
We wanted to bring them home to the family, regardless of whether we knew the air was going to be bad to breathe. We knew we had a job to do, and we were going to do it either way.
Another first responder, John Field, described his reaction to the settlement on CBS News this morning.
It's an indication in a way that we're not crying wolf for the last 8.5 years. We are sick from 9/11.
A judge and the plaintiffs still need to agree to the deal.
Two other big stories. Retail sales showing a surprising increase for February, and it's moving the markets. The advance of 0.3%, biggest since November. And Tiger Woods expected to return to golf for the Masters tournament at Augusta in April. That'll get some big numbers. According to the Associated Press, Woods has not played since November when he won the Australian Masters. 12 days later, his big scandal began. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we learn what else our listeners thought Haitians need from the United States and the world. Your responses, your stories, and your voices in a moment.
We have some takeouts on news stories that we're following right now. And, of course, there's lots of arguments, right, John, going on in D.C.? No dearth of arguments over the stimulus, new bills to help the unemployed.
Just landed in a big box right on my doorstep.
That's weird, because that's what happened in Florida, too.
Really?
Kind of. Yeah, they got like a big box, sort of.
Nobody can find it, though.
Right. So we actually sent someone down to Florida with you to check out how the stimulus money is being spent in Florida and really how people feel about the expenditures. We're joined now by Takeaway transportation reporter Colin Campbell. You went to Polk County. Why did you go to Polk County?
Well, Polk County is halfway between Orlando and Tampa, and it's kind of smack in the middle of the Florida high-speed rail route. So this is the big ticket of the stimulus. We talked a couple weeks ago about the projects you might remember from the stimulus. This could be one of them. It's a 90-mile train route, and Polk County is right in the middle. It's that train route's being paid for by more than $1 billion in stimulus money. And the project goes between Tampa and Orlando. It goes through Republican counties. It goes through purple parts of the country. These are the hard-fought areas of Florida politics. These are, you know, where the narrative of whether the stimulus is working or not will be settled.
So, can I ride this rail?
You can't ride the rail until probably 2015, they hope, although there's sort of some cracks showing in it. But
they must be pretty happy about it there.
You would think, yeah. It's kind of a rural place with cows and oranges and strawberries. It's also a place with 13% unemployment. They need the money. And that's where I found Billy Gay. He's an immigrant from Costa Rica. I talked to him outside a diner in the morning. He was going to his truck where he was going to do some sod work, some grass work. He also works in a phosphate mine in Lakeland, Florida. And he's an Obama voter. He voted for Obama in 2008. And I asked him if he'd vote for Obama again. He said no. And I asked him what he thought of the stimulus. Here's what he told me.
I don't understand the stimulus money, the spending of the money, the way that they doing, and I don't think they're actually helping the small little guy like me.
Okay, so in Florida, they don't like the stimulus package because it's not trickling down to the local level. That's right?
I think they're waiting to see it. I think they're waiting to see it trickle down. The second person I talked to was a woman called Dina Stebbins DeCamp. She runs a custom embroidery business in Lakeland. Business is off 30%, and I think you would have thought Billy Gay there might have seen a little bit of stimulus money. Dina Stebbins DeCamp kind of looking around Lakeland to see the effects. Doesn't look good to her. She also runs the Republican Women's Club of Lakeland, so you'd expect she'd be a little skeptical of the Obama administration. And she's also an organizer of the Tea Party there.
Oh, well, geez.
So this is somebody you expect, if you believe what you see on TV, to be frothing at the mouth at the talk of $1 billion,
right.
A touchy-feely project like a high-speed train. Here's what she told me about the high-speed rail.
People are so desperate to pay their mortgages and keep their jobs, and the government's spending money that we really don't have yet. But we're actually very happy about the bullet train. We think it's a good thing for Florida.
Okay, so she's happy about the bullet train. So maybe they don't think it's getting out of the little guy, but they're happy about the big ticket projects.
I think they'd like to see the big ticket projects run in a financially responsible way. You know, Dina gave me a couple other ideas. Stimulus money could go for tax cuts. It could go to things that they'd see a little quicker. So, you know, the ambivalence about the stimulus funding could be leading to a little bit of ambivalence about the high-speed rail project itself, you know, which is a problem. It only covers 90 miles. This is something that the White House is trying to get done quickly, you know, to really show off. This is stimulus money at work here, jobs. Here's a train you can ride. And so I found Troy Keener, a retired guy. He's kind of a lifelong resident of Polk County. He used to work for the DOT. This is the kind of guy you'd also expect to be pretty bullish on a train.
And what do you have to say?
And I asked him, you know, would you ride the train? Here's what Troy said.
People's not going to pay the money to ride the train. I mean, only the rich and famous are going to be able to afford to do it. And then when they get there, how are they going to get off? They're going to get a cab? They pay a cab fare? No, I don't think so. I mean, how is they going to get around from the train station to where they want to go to? You know, if I have to ride it to Orlando to go to Bass Pro Shop, I've got to catch a cab there, and I'm not paying a cab driver his fee to take me there and pick me up and take me back. I'd rather drive it.
Okay, so it sounds to me like the really what's at issue here is that Floridians themselves don't entirely agree on what it is that they want, which makes it very difficult for the Obama administration to address that with stimulus funds. But thanks. That's our takeaway transportation reporter Colin Campbell bringing us ambiguity from Florida.
Ambiguity from Florida. As Carl Hyacinth said, the epicenter of sleaze. Yes, indeed. So you've been responding all week long. What do people need in Haiti? Well, we've heard they need jobs already this hour, but what else?
My name is Charlie Florestal. I'm a Haitian American. What Haiti needs from the world right now, the only one thing Haiti needs is for the world to help end corruption in Haiti. Haiti is the most corrupted country in the world today.
My name is James. I'm calling from Pembroke Pines, Florida. What Haiti needs is education. As a first-generation Haitian American, the key to developing this nation is education.
My name is Regine Cambron with Baptist Health of Florida. We are the largest healthcare system in Florida. We are coordinating to assemble 1 million meals for Haiti.
Lots of clarity there from Floridians specifics about what happens in Florida and what Florida needs, or Haiti needs.
You can get more of our Haiti coverage at our site, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can catch up on a story we brought you yesterday. 2010 could be the tipping point when there will be more babies of color than white babies born in the United States. This sparked a lively discussion among our listeners, what you think about the labels of majority and minority. We got some racial zen from Frank in New York.
There's a lot of fear, a lot of envy, jealousy around race and majority-minority. And so it's very important to stay focused. And what I would say is, listen, we're the drops of one ocean and the leaves of one tree, and then mankind is one.
Jennifer in Salt Lake City, though, she wanted to get at the greater issue of racism. And she writes that while being colorblind may be a long-term goal, it's not how we currently live in this country. Jennifer says we live in a society that's mostly unconsciously biased by people's skin color. Until we all become aware of this and consciously make change, we're going to continue to allow our systems and institutions to perpetuate racism.
Lots of comments about that and other things at thetakeaway.org. You know how to reach us. Today's question, of course, is because of daylight savings time, what if you could expand the clock? What would you have more time for?
My name is Tony, and I'm driving across Iowa right now. And if I had an extra hour, I would spend it with my wife. Being the fact that I'm gone so much, I just miss to have the time with my wife.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, congressmen are exempt from arrest when they're sitting in Congress, when they're on their way to Congress, in lots of cases. But the question then becomes, if congressmen misbehave, if they engage in misconduct, who polices them? Unfortunately, the answer is themselves. And we're going to talk about the House Ethics Committee in a moment. But first, let's check on news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. House Democrats are meeting again this hour to talk about the plan to pass a health care reform bill. The White House is hoping it'll come up to a vote next week, with President Obama announcing just last hour that he's delaying his trip to Asia by 3 days in order to be involved in the process. Staying with health care, new reports show the mandated health care coverage system in Massachusetts is expanding access for the state's Latino population. Earlier, we spoke to Robert Pomales of the Latin American Institute.
We have seen a significant increase in the number covered by insurance now, and that has certainly resulted in better connection to health care for the Latino population.
Yesterday, the president met with the Black and Latino House caucuses.
Maybe a settlement for more than 10,000 rescue workers who say they got sick from the dust at Ground Zero after the 9/11 attacks. If they and a judge agree to the deal, cops, firefighters, and some construction workers would share up to $657 million from a federal grant. And the man known as the father of Bossa Nova has passed away.
Tall and tame, young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking. And
Johnny Alf, influential Brazilian singer and songwriter, died this week in São Paulo of prostate cancer. He began his career playing on what was known then as Bottle Alley, the Copacabana street full of bars and nightclubs. From there, he hooked up with other artists that are today widely credited for making Bossa Nova known internationally. Johnny Alf was 80 years old. So retail sales' surprising bounce has given the markets a push. The Dow is open. It's 22 points up. The S&P up about 3 points, and the NASDAQ up about 4.5 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All this week, we've been talking about political dysfunction in New York, Illinois, and, of course, in Florida. But, you know, in Washington, D.C., of course, they generally have... they're the professionals.
Now they're saying I groped a male staffer. Yeah, I did.
That's, of course, Eric Massa, who claims he was not actually groping his staffers. He was tickling them as part of his birthday celebration. Needless to say, allegations of tickling or groping on the part of a congressman get the media talking. And that made another lawmaker, Patrick Kennedy, get really upset.
There's two press people in this gallery. We're talking about Eric Massa 24/7 on the TV.
But, you know, allegations of misconduct in Congress, they're not new, are they?
I committed no wrongdoing whatsoever.
You don't want to give up the perks of power, the chairmanships.
And I'm a high-profile person.
So why do we have so many scandals out of Washington? Isn't anybody looking into this, trying to prevent these things from happening? It's true, sitting congressmen can't be arrested, so who actually polices our lawmakers? Who watches Congress? Congress does, actually, and that could be part of the problem. The body that uses that Congress uses to police itself is the House Ethics Committee. Marion Wang is here to talk about this. She's a reporter and blogger for ProPublica. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning.
So just yesterday, the news is the House has decided to continue their investigation into former Democratic New York Congressman Eric Massa. He resigned on Monday. But what are they investigating?
Well, what I think they're investigating this time is actually for the situation and the handling of, you know, the investigation around Massa to be investigated. So I think what John Boehner was asking for yesterday was that, particularly with House Democrats, how they handled it, what they knew, when they knew it, and whether there was any cover-up involved.
Whether or not Massa was forced out, you mean?
Well, actually, you know, with Nancy Pelosi's office, when did they know about the allegations and what did they do? Did they do nothing? And it's the same type of investigation that actually happened around Mark Foley in 2006, just when the tables were turned. The minority party wanted to know how the majority had handled it when one of their own was, you know, under investigation.
So the House Ethics Committee, we don't always know exactly what happens in there. They're a relatively secretive body.
That's right.
So do we only know what they come out to the podium and announce during press conferences?
You know, pretty much. The committee had actually been investigating Massa for a month before media reports started coming out about the investigation, at which point they came out and said, yes, we are investigating him, but they really didn't address any of the allegations. So it was just a one-line statement. And that's typically how they operate.
Okay, well, let's bring John Bresnahan into this conversation. He's the senior congressional reporter for Politico. John, you've actually been covering the House Ethics Committee for years, and would you say that this is a fairly dysfunctional entity?
I would say it can be at times, it can be completely dysfunctional. There were years when it did very little publicly in terms of policing members. For a while there in the early 2000s, basically Congress ceded authority or ceded a lot of authority to the Justice Department, which actually charged a bunch of members. So, yeah, there are times when it doesn't work. They've tried to make reforms. They work intermittently. It's a very difficult situation for members.
Well, now, the House Ethics Committee is there as a body to investigate allegations of misconduct on the part of congressmen, because congressmen are exempt, as I said earlier, from arrest, except in the cases of something like a felony. But
well, they can be arrested. They can't be arrested if they're voting.
In attendance.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Or on their way to Congress or
exactly.
Something like that. So how efficiently do they perform that duty? Are they a good watchdog, or is this a political tool?
No, they're not a good watchdog, generally speaking. A lot of what the Ethics Committee, actually their official name is the Committee on Standards of Official Conduct, is mundane. They review financial disclosure reports. They give advice on trips or gifts. I mean, they do a lot behind the scenes. In terms of actually charging members, investigating members, the problem is they're not a law enforcement body. And members don't want to serve on the Ethics Committee. They do it because they're asked to. It's an onerous duty. But the problem is they imagine themselves sitting where a member under investigation is, and that just scares the heck out of them. So that they tend to look for ways out of problems, and they're very slow and they're very secretive. I've been covering it for years. Once in a while, you'll get a leak. There was a leaked document last year by the Washington Post that they got by a staff member, mistakenly put on the internet somewhere, and somebody grabbed it and leaked it to the Post, and it showed a bunch of stuff that was going on behind the scenes, but you never really see it. It's very difficult to know what's going on.
But are they fair? We have two congressmen who are under investigation, Eric Massa and Charlie Rangel. Are they both being treated the same in the Ethics Committee?
Well, Massa technically himself is no longer under investigation. The Ethics Committee has no jurisdiction over somebody who doesn't belong to Congress. Now, Rangel would probably argue after he's been admonished by the committee, it's the least severe penalty they could have, but he's still under investigation for a bunch of other stuff. He didn't think what they did was fair to him, because they admonished him and let a couple other members off for the exact same thing. I think they bend over too far, to be fair. And the problem was in the 90s, it became a battleground. It became a political battleground. Members were just filing complaints against each other and outside groups. And then they reformed the rules so that no outside groups could file a complaint. And since that time, for the last decade or more than the last decade, the committee has really it's had a very difficult time being credible.
John Bresnahan, senior congressional reporter for Politico, talking about the House Ethics Committee. And also, we spoke with Marian Wang, reporter and blogger for ProPublica. Thanks to both of you. And as your weekend starts, remember that we're going to lose an hour this weekend to daylight saving time, so you have to spring your clocks ahead 1 hour before you get to bed on Saturday night. And, of course, this got us thinking about time. What would you do with more time? Don in New York posts to our site, I'd like to have more time to listen to the radio, but only if I have a speed up or skip button to get past stuff I don't want to hear, like John singing.
It's time to try defying gravity.
Where did you
I think
that?
I'll try defying.
I don't blame you, Don. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
In this corner, John Huckenberry. And sports story for the next couple of minutes, folks. If you are a boxing fan this Saturday and you're looking forward to a particular title match taking place down in Arlington, Texas, you may not know that you're actually possibly witnessing the largest candidate town meeting event in the history of global politics. That's right. When WBO welterweight champion Manny Pacquiao defends his title on Saturday, he's also running for office back in his home country, the Philippines, and every one of those folks in the Philippines who's watching that fight could conceivably be voters. Steve Farhood is a boxing analyst for Showtime. He's met Manny Pacquiao and is here to preview this weekend's action. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How are you, John?
I love the town meeting aspect, but most people are tuning in for the boxing, of course, right?
I hope so, and it better be good boxing at that price. Let me
what is the pay-per-view price?
I believe it's 49 or 55, but Manny Pacquiao is very exciting, consistently exciting, so people usually get their money's worth.
No, and in fact, that's really the driver here. Pacquiao is an exciting fighter to watch. He's something that the boxing game really, really needs right now. Who's he up against, and what are his chances?
Well, he's up against Josh Clatty, who's a fighter from Ghana, who's a legitimate contender, but unfortunately, it's really it's not the fight we wanted to see. We wanted to see Pacquiao against Floyd Mayweather, who's unbeaten and was the pound-for-pound best fighter in the world until a brief retirement. So we're hoping still that that fight will materialize because that's the fight that would really help boxing. But in the meantime, this is Pacquiao staying busy and Mayweather staying busy with his own fight in a month or two.
Style of these two fighters, and of course the Mayweather issue, you know, it's natural for the big match to be sort of dangled out there, especially when you can get these like $55 a pop pay-per-view fees. Is this stylistically a good match, even though it's not the one everyone wants?
Yeah, it's almost impossible with Pacquiao not to have a pleasing match stylistically because he's aggressive, he's a big puncher, and Clatty is a puncher as well, a little bit slow and ponderous, but a very aggressive fighter, not a boxer and a mover. So style-wise, it should be very pleasing.
The fascinating thing about Pacquiao, though, is that unlike a lot of fighters, he's really worked out what he's going to be doing after he leaves the ring, right?
Oh, God. He is amazing. He's a professional singer. He's been in action movies in the Philippines. The country idolizes him. It virtually stops every time he fights. And, of course, he's running for a congressional seat for the second time, I might add, in the Philippines. And, John, the irony of it is, from what I hear, the reason he lost the first time and the reason he's expected to lose, at least by prognosticators this time, is because the people love him as a fighter. And as much as they love him, they don't want to lose him as a fighter.
So no matter how good he is, he can't win, right?
Exactly. Yeah. If he wins in the ring, he's probably going to lose in the congressional seat because his people back home will want to see him fight Mayweather.
So, Steve, we've got to figure out a bumper sticker for Pacquiao here. So what can he say? I'll still fight. Don't worry. Elect me or something like
or
that.
Or I can't win for winning. Something like that. Exactly.
I'll never lose my left hook.
Right.
Finally, is this a power fighter or a finesse fighter, Manny Pacquiao, for people who haven't seen him?
He's a very exciting action fighter, I put it that way. He's a power puncher. He scores a lot of knockouts, but he brings his speed, and he's become a tremendous, tremendous fighter, someone who the experts are saying now is among the greatest not only of his day but of all time.
All right. To Steve Farhood, boxing analyst for Showtime, if you got 55 bucks, check it out. Manny Pacquiao defending his WBA welterweight championship on Saturday in Texas.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, the pros and cons of being a genius. Pros, You get excused on things like fashion or hairstyle. If you're somebody like Einstein, they let stuff like that
go. Works for me.
Cons, you have to spend about 10,000 hours practicing whatever it is you want to be a genius
at. Well, unless you're a really, really good genius.
That's true, unless you're like, you know, super, super genius. We're going to talk about that in a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In the past hour, we've learned that President Obama will delay his trip to Asia so he can continue working on health care. The trip was originally scheduled for March 18th. It'll be bumped to the 21st. Also, House Democrats are expected to meet in the next few minutes to work out the remaining kinks in the health care proposal.
So any idea how bad Lehman Brothers was before it went bankrupt? We thought it was too big to fail. Turns out on paper it may have barely existed at the time of it filed for bankruptcy, according to a new report. We asked BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker to explain.
We have a bank that indeed had been doing its accounts in a way that gave what the report found to be a misleading impression of its financial condition. There are some particular transactions that were made in the course of 2008 that were designed, according to the report by an American attorney, to make its borrowings in relation to its capital, shareholders' capital, look more moderate than in truth they were. And the conclusion is that there might actually even be a case for legal action to recover compensation from some former executives, including the former CEO, Dick Fuld,
sure,
and also from the auditors, the accountancy firm Ernst & Young. So, you know, and there are some uncomfortable echoes, I think, there of the of what happened with Enron, because, of course, that absolutely trashed the reputation of its auditors, the accountancy firm Arthur Andersen.
A couple of quick mind-boggling details. How do you erase $50 billion, and what is Repo 105 in the report?
Well, the idea of that is that a repo is where you sell some financial asset to somebody else and make a commitment to buy it back at some stage in the future. And the point for doing this in this particular case was that the week or so of that contract was a period when Lehman's quarterly balance sheet was being worked out. And that meant that there were a bunch of assets off its balance sheet on the key day, which just made it look a little bit less precarious than in truth it was. That was what it was all about. And interestingly, there's also you may be surprised to know there is a British angle on this story, because Lehman wanted a bit of legal cover for this, couldn't get an American lawyer to sign off to give an opinion saying this was okay. So they came over here and got it from a London firm, Freshfields.
Yes, there we go. That's right. I get my tax form signed off by a British lawyer every year.
And I think I got the name of the lawyers wrong, but it was a British firm of lawyers that gave them the legal cover for doing this.
It was Andrew Walker, economics correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Still time to give us a sense of what you would do if you had an extra hour. It's daylight savings this week. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. You lose an hour, but what would you do if you gained one? Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Super genius.
What is genius?
Putting a man on the moon or inventing the internet.
I got a lot of PhD types and smart people around me.
The genius.
A stroke of genius.
Of the crowd.
A true musical genius.
Nature versus nurture.
The way he plays the game, he's just a genius out there in the court.
The American dream is being able to make a living with what you are a genius at.
We have been talking about genius all week long, and David Shank is back with us. He wrote the new book, The Genius in All of Us. And David, bear with me here. Let's talk about what we've learned so far this week. What separates a genius from the rest of us is really not so much. We have the possibility, the capability, all of us do, to become a genius, right?
Right. It's our genes. We are not doomed to mediocrity by our genes. Our genes are actually built to adapt to our life circumstances and what we demand of them and what we demand of our bodies and brains.
Right. We can reprogram our genes if we want to. And that's your whole thesis, is that genius is a process and practice.
Absolutely.
And you have to have the drive to want to do this.
Absolutely.
Right. But you also mentioned that in some cases people talk about the 10,000 hours of practice.
Well, it takes a long time. No one's saying this is easy. And it also requires extraordinary sacrifice to be truly great at something. Not just time, but relationships, tremendous energy, and cost, money. John knows all this already, but you know the rest of us have to learn.
We're going to get a spin. We're going to get a call from his wife here in a moment if you keep doing that. But you know, let's talk a little bit about that sacrifice, because you know I've known a few geniuses in my life, and not only do they have to sacrifice, but if they are married, if they have children, the other people in their life have to sacrifice when you have somebody that dedicated to something.
Right. So the lesson here is not that everyone should, you know, give up everything to become, you know, a Mozart or a Sarah Chang or whatever. The lesson here is that you're not doomed to mediocrity. Put that excuse aside and decide how great you want to be and what sacrifices you want to make. And I'm not saying this is all in your control, but it is more in your control and in your family's control than you think. So make the decision about how great you want to be and what you want to give to that ambition.
And throw away your copy of The Bell Curve, which said that we were all doomed to be what our genes programmed us for.
Please do.
Well, let's bring in Jenny Niles. She's founder and head of the school at the E.L. Haynes Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. How are you guys this morning?
I'm doing well, thanks. We're talking to you because your school has been very successful at doing some of the things that David talks about in his book, in finding the talents in each of your students and developing them. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, the foundational components of what David's written about is actually how we've organized the whole school. And it really has profound implications for education and how we need to have schools organized to make sure that every single child is ready to go to college and is ready to be as successful as possible.
Okay, but you had a lottery at your school last week, and you had to turn away a lot of disappointed parents. I mean, not everybody can get into a school that's going to do that for them and structure it for them. So give me some tips. How does one, with your child or with yourself, how do you go about doing this?
Yep. You know, I was looking again at David's book because I had jotted some notes even before then, and I think he really sums it up incredibly powerfully. I mean, the first piece is believe. Believe that this is actually possible. And this is what all parents need to believe about their kids, is not that they have something that if they're, small, they can't be a great athlete or whatever it is. They need to actually believe in that potential and that the possibility of genius. The second piece really is that I think a key point about supporting the child but not making it so that they're living vicariously through the child. We've all seen stories of this. It's certainly well documented in various movies and in tabloids. But parents need they can't link rewarding kids with their love and affection for success, and thus withholding it for failure, because parents need to provide that unconditional love for children, regardless of their success or failure. And that also builds into that next one, which is you've got to be able to, as a parent, help kids learn how to practice. And in fact, it's not just a generic kind of practice. You need to think about a specific way of practicing that actually builds the skills. And then I think the last one is crucial for all parents, which is regard failure as something that kids can learn from. It's not the end of the world, and the sooner that our students and that our young people and that your sons and daughters know that, the better it is, and the more sturdy they'll be as a person and the more resilient.
That's great advice. You know, David, in this whole book, there's a kind of a singular genius that you knock down, but there's a collective genius that seems to replace it. Is that the lesson here? And there's a scientific basis for that collective genius, working together, bringing out people's potential.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, you know, one of the really important points here is that culture has so much to do with this. So it's not just about you and your child and what you guys can do. It's about this, and this isn't just a short-term thing. This isn't about one lifetime. This is about building over many, many generations this idea that we can do better, that there isn't a whole population that's just kind of doomed to inferior achievement, that if we believe more in ourselves and we apply the principles that some of us have learned, that we can get there.
David Shank, the author of The Genius in All of Us, a concept we've been looking at all week long.
Think he's a genius?
I think he's pretty dang smart. We also spoke with Jenny Niles, founder and head of the school at the E.L. Haynes Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. You can learn more about our Genius series and read an excerpt from David Shank's book, see audio examples of genius throughout history. You can catch up and weigh in on everything on our site, thetakeaway.org.
Feel like a genius. Listen to The Takeaway. And you know, hey, you geniuses out there, be sure to set your clocks, all right? Unless you live in Arizona or Hawaii, we lose an hour to daylight saving time this weekend. So, you know, don't forget, which got us thinking about time. Your question all day today has been, what do you wish there was more time for?
This is Nancy from Farmington Hills, Michigan. And if I had an extra hour as a working mom,
I would use that hour to do something that I want to do, not for my family, whether that's work out or do a hobby.
Camille in Slovenia said, I'm a housewife, I have no children, and I have all the time in the world, but I find everything else to do besides working on my novel, like posting to takeaway.org. Camille, get your act together. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend, whatever you do with your time. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is To The Takeaway, Super Genius.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.